Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, and your moderator for tonight. We'd also like to welcome our listeners on the radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers, Chairman of the American Freedom Agenda, Bruce Fine, and former United States Congressman of the 7th District in Georgia, Bob Barr. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Thank you.
These gentlemen are here tonight to talk about the American Freedom Agenda, which was formed by a group of leading conservatives who are challenging the Bush administration's policies with regard to usurping legislative and judicial authority. The discussion tonight is going to focus on the first concerted and highly public effort on the part of conservatives to repudiate and challenge the Bush administration and uphold the government's responsibility to the U.S. Constitution and the rule of law. I'd like to start the discussion with introductory remarks from each of our guests. Let's start with the chairman of the American Freedom Agenda, Bruce Fine. Mr. Fine is a Harvard graduate who served during the Reagan administration in the Department of Justice. Mr. Fine, good evening.
Thank you. I'd like to begin my remarks by paraphrasing one of our founding fathers. And if he were here today, I think he'd say as follows. Caesar had his Brutus, Charles I his Cromwell, and President George W. Bush and Dick Cheney should learn by those examples. They have asserted powers that exceed anything that was indicted against King George III in the Declaration of Independence. If they would have read an earlier portion of that, they would have recognized that our rights are not at the sufferance of the President and the Vice President, who can desist from claiming we're on a battlefield where he can proclaim martial law anymore and at any moment. But our rights are inalienable. We are endowed by our Creator with a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and they depend upon no monarch's grace. Let me outline some of the more egregious usurpations that make you and all of the American people less safe in light of the President's precedents that he is setting, that other foreign leaders may follow and are discouraging foreign governments from cooperating with the United States in attacking international terrorism. Now, just last week, a British parliamentary committee reported that the British were resisting cooperating with our CIA in conducting important covert operations because they feared detainees would be tortured or they would be maltreated at Guantanamo Bay. We have at present 26 former CIA operatives under indictment in Italy because they kidnapped and sent to Egypt for torturing an individual on President Bush's say-so alone that he was a terrorist. Apparently, they got it wrong. He's now suing for redress. In Germany, 13 former CIA operatives are under arrest warrants because they kidnapped a German citizen in Macedonia, dispatched him to Afghanistan for brutal treatment in a prison, dumped him back in Albania. He is now suing in the United States courts. He has been told by the CIA he can't win under the state secrets doctrine because to expose the culprits would be to expose a state secret, an undercover agent. Now, what do these kinds of cowboy-like assertions do to the safety of the United States? Think this. The doctrine that's being propounded is that the President of the United States may identify on his say-so alone anyone as a criminal or a terrorist abroad. On his say-so alone, dispatch our CIA or other covert operatives to kidnap that individual, place them in prison, torture them, and dump them out. Now, think of you perhaps visiting Paris. Vladimir Putin, the President of Russia, thinks you're sympathetic to the Chechens. He sends the current version of the KGB to kidnap you, send you to a Belarus prison, say you're there indefinitely without a lawyer. And you ask him, well, how can you do this? Well, President George W. Bush has set the example. And Mr. Putin would be correct. Now, what else is President Bush doing that's causing us to be less safe? He is asserting a power to identify any American citizen or non-citizen as an enemy combatant on his say-so alone. Now, what is an enemy combatant? It's not confined to someone who's picked up on an active battlefield of hostilities attempting to kill an American. Anyone who has any affiliation, has displayed any kind of support, moral support or otherwise, can be identified as an enemy combatant without any judicial review, sent to Guantanamo Bay for indefinite detention based upon secret evidence, and those detainees do not have access to a lawyer. If they wish to challenge their detentions, they can go before what's called the Combatant Status Review Tribunal. And before that tribunal, the government is presumed to be correct and infallible. That's an instruction of Mr. Bush, who also claims that title to infallibility. He never made a mistake during his, 6 years, maybe since birth. I think he thinks he issues encyclicals like the Vatican on issues of faith and morals, but he does seem to get it wrong more than once. But based upon a kangaroo court, you are then subject to detention, basically for life, because the president says that we are in the a condition of warfare under the Constitution. Any time that there's one individual on the planet, whether in Bhutan or otherwise, who on the top of a mountain threatens to kill an American, then we are at war. Now, under that standard, the war is endless. And James Madison informed us, with perpetual war, there can be no freedom, because we're in a constant state of jeopardy that the president will declare martial law and will have military justice everywhere. You know this old saying goes, military music is to music what military justice is to justice. And that is based upon a core truth. It's not because necessarily they're evil-minded people, but remember, military justice is what the Founding Fathers described as the very essence of tyranny, because it combines the prosecution function, the judicial function, and the jury function in the same branch. And you don't get acquittals when the same person who charges you is the same person who decides whether their charge was accurate or not. Now, what else is the president doing that's setting a very menacing standard for the United States? You know that the main challenge in defeating international terrorism is to dry up recruits. Well, one of the best recruiting tools that Al Jazeera and Al-Qaeda have is examples of abuses. The Mahir Arabs, he was a Syrian-Canadian citizen who he deported to Syria, where he was tortured and dumped back into Canada. We refused to apologize, although the Canadians have paid him over $1 million, said we made a mistake. Mr. Al-Masri, who the Germans have insisted was not complicit in any wrongdoing, is now someone who is shown to have been brutalized in Afghan prisons and is put on Al Jazeera TV, like Abu Ghraib victims and otherwise, in order to encourage the disappointed and disaffected youth in the Middle East to join Al-Qaeda. It's the recruitment that comes from our injustices that makes us less safe. Every time that there is an example of someone in Guantanamo Bay has been unjustly held, the people who recruit for Al-Qaeda say, see, this shows Bush isn't against terrorism. He just doesn't like those who subscribe to Islam. Now, one of the reasons why I think Bush has been so bold at present is because he's targeted the abuse at people whose names are difficult to pronounce. They're not Jones and Brown. No, they're Al-Masri and Hamdan and Hamdi. But that may play in the United States. It certainly is not something that's effective in trying to convey to those who are in the Middle East and are the best recruits, or would-be recruits for Al-Qaeda, that we are applying even-handed justice. And then the last element, I suppose, that makes us less safe is that President Bush is setting an example of lawlessness that discourages Democrats and rule of law proponents abroad from believing that we would come to their aid in trying to turn their regimes from despotisms into democracies, which would provide less fertile ground for jihadists to be developed. Now, what are the ways in which the president is disregarding the rule of law? Well, as is often said, as a concession to the shortness of life, I will limit the cases. But as a small sample, first, he claims the right to flout the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978 in gathering foreign intelligence. What his argument is that post 9/11, he has been crowned with authority to do anything he wants to gather foreign intelligence, and Congress has no authority to limit what he does into that banner of foreign intelligence, meaning he can open our mail, break and enter into our homes, kidnap us, surveil our emails, international phone calls, all on his say-so alone, because he's gathering foreign intelligence. Indeed, he's gone so far to say he can commit torture in the name of gathering foreign intelligence, even when he has signed a bill that prohibits torture, which leads us to another element of his lawlessness. Under his theory of the presidency, he's endowed with power to sign a bill into law and then say, but I won't comply with the portions that I don't agree with and I say are unconstitutional. Now, if he knew his history, which he doesn't, he would remember that King James II was overthrown because he was claiming the comparable power to dispense with the laws of recusancy because James was favorable to the Catholics at the time. And for that reason, the Founding Fathers wrote into Article 2 of the Constitution an obligation that the president take care that the laws be faithfully executed. It's very clear, lucid, unambiguous language. But the president is interpreting that to mean that he is entitled to sabotage the faithful execution of the laws by these signing statements, where he declares without any judicial review what the Constitution means, what powers he has, and then ends up enforcing a law that Congress didn't pass. Congress only votes on an entire bill, not on a Swiss cheese edition. The other elements that the president is employing, showing how he has a sneering contempt for the law, was revealed just last week. Bob, you may recall, July 17th, he issued an order under what's called the International Economic Emergencies Powers Act. Stunning. He says that on his say-so alone, he can identify anyone in the United States as creating a, quote, significant risk of undermining the reconstruction program in Iraq or political reform by creating a risk that an act of violence might be committed. And when he identifies you, he doesn't inform you, but you are instantly subject to a financial death penalty. All your assets are frozen. No one then can do any business with you. In fact, if Bob or I were a lawyer who offered you, if you're on this list, legal services to challenge the constitutionality of what was done, we would be guilty of a crime. If a doctor came to offer services because someone suffered a cardiac arrest, they would be guilty of a crime for providing any services to someone who is on the list. The list, of course, is not public, so you don't even know whether you are placing yourself in jeopardy by providing support, services, or goods to someone who's been blacklisted. Now, this is something that goes far beyond the worst days of McCarthyism. At least there they provided an attorney general's list that was public. This is not required even to be public. Now, a president who had a decent respect for the Constitution would have had some lawyers. Maybe he had Alberto Gonzalez look at this before it signed. And that was why it was so replete with constitutional errors and omissions. But something of this seriousness and gravity is not to be joked about. And yet the president treats the Constitution and the rule of law with this sneering attitude of, oh, why, if I can be president, do I have to obey any other injunctions? He may decide to quit and go back to Crawford, Texas, if we harass him with the Constitution. But those are my closing observations. I just make this last remark. The Constitution is a document more for us in this room than it is for public officials. They are all power-hungry. They are all engaged in maneuvering for partisan purposes. We aren't. We have an oath, even if it's not taken in a formal way like the president, to enforce the Constitution and scrutinize our public officials and insist they be sanctioned, removed from office for flagrant violations, because it's our liberty that's endangered. And I think that we all in this room have an obligation to insist that there be movement in the Congress to make certain that the kind of violations that we've witnessed repeatedly, far in excess of anything King George did that evoked the Declaration of Independence, result in some sanctions and the removal from office of those who can't be trusted with power. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce Fine. As you can imagine, your comments are generating quite a few audience questions. We'll get those in a minute after Mr. Barr. But first, a reminder that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speakers tonight are Bruce Fine and former Congressman Bob Barr. I'm John Diaz, moderating tonight's program. We now welcome Bob Barr to make his introductory comments. Mr. Barr?
Thank you, John, and it's an honor to appear once again with the Commonwealth Club of California and its many, many listeners who take time from those things that legitimately occupy so much of our time, but members of the Commonwealth Club and members of this listening audience do something that far too few of our fellow citizens do. They take time out on a regular basis from all of those things that do occupy our time, education, jobs, family, religion, community, to listen to speakers who discuss issues of both current and historic importance, to take time out to debate, question, and discuss these issues. And if there's one thought that I think is important that permeates what Bruce just said and what I think you come away with from every meeting of this Commonwealth Club of California, and that is the need to remind people just how important public discourse and private debate among ourselves, as Bruce said, is so important to the quality not just of our lives and our community and our time, but to our fellow citizens all across this land and to those in so many foreign lands who still legitimately look to America as the beacon of liberty. Let me, John, if I could, pick up where my very learned friend and colleague Bruce Fine left off, and that is with the Constitution itself, the document that I consider the greatest document penned by the hand of man. I had read a book recently called Young Patriots by a gentleman by the name of Charles Cerami, and he recounts largely the thought process and the writing, the drafting of the Constitution by Mr. Madison and Mr. Hamilton and others. And toward the end of this book, Young Patriots, Mr. Cerami makes the point that one would think, looking at our Constitution, looking at America's importance and influence in the world, that other countries in the more than two centuries since we adopted the Constitution as the foundational document for our country and our society, that many countries would have emulated that experience. And if you go to, for example, the U.S. Archives or the Library of Congress and look at the constitutions that are operative in the world in this year 2007, or those that have been operative in the world in the years since the adoption of our Constitution well more than two centuries ago, you might expect to see many, many examples of constitutions where they have copied, if not word for word, certainly the fundamental principles and structure of our society, representing as it does this, as Mr. Reagan called it, the last best hope of man on earth. Yet Mr. Cerami, Charles Cerami, when he researched his book, The Young Patriots, and he went to and spent a great deal of time at the Library of Congress looking at, poring over constitutions, current and prior, from around the world, he found not a single constitution, not a single document operative in the world or since ours, that was similar to ours. And it got me thinking, why is that? Why is this document, the Constitution that Bruce talks about, and to which all of our national public officials and public officials at the local and state government swear an oath, why is it that it is not emulated and copied over and over and over again around the world? I think it's probably because it's a document that scares government. The Constitution of the United States is a frightening document to governments, whether they are in Europe, here in our own hemisphere, or anywhere else. Why? Because it is a document that tells the government, you are not all-powerful. As a matter of fact, you have and will have only so much power as we elect and voluntarily or allow you to have. And that's a frightening thought for government, because why does government exist? Why do governments exist? Governments exist to control. Governments exist to gain, use, and retain power. And as our founding fathers so magnificently realized, power comes from one source only, and that is the people. The people have the power. We are given the power not by government, but by, as Bruce said, our Creator. And we loan that power to government. But it's also important to keep in mind that no government in this country or other countries is ever satisfied with the amount of power that it inherits from its predecessor. Every government looks at the power, considers the power that it obtains and inherits from its predecessor government as a floor, not a ceiling, but a floor of power on which they build. They look for new ways. And this administration is no different, except in one respect. It has sought and continues to seek power in an unprecedented manner. There is not, as far as this scholar or student of the Constitution can tell, any prior administration, any administration in our history that has viewed with such disdain the Constitution and what it stands for, these United States and this administration. You see it in ways large and small. Bruce has recounted several recent examples. The decision by the current administration to completely ignore, almost proudly ignore, the laws of this land, duly passed by prior and current Congresses and signed by prior presidents, that set out, for example, the rules under which the government might surveil, might conduct surveillance of American citizens in this country. Prior administrations have recognized that laws, for example, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that was passed and signed by a prior president 30 years ago in 1978, properly dictates, whether they like it or not, properly dictates and tells any president the circumstances under which they can conduct surreptitious surveillance of American citizens in this country. Now, prior presidents have looked at laws like that and made a calculated decision. Can we operate within the bounds of that law? Can we carry out the duties and responsibilities that we as the president see in this place and time during our administration within the constraints of that law, or can't we? And if we can't, then we go to the Congress of the United States, which passed the original law back in 1978, and seek to amend it. Make our case to the people. Make our case to the Congress. This administration looks at the laws of this land and the Constitution as something very different. They look at them as something to be ignored when you can and to be moved around like pieces on a chessboard whenever they kind of get in your way. We see this in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act ignorance, the ignoring of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act by the current administration. We see it in many other ways as well, large and small. Let's take a small way that really goes, again, to sort of the nature of how this administration views the Constitution and laws of this land and the entire structure of government. Back during the Cold War era in East Germany, there was a state agency called Stasi, S-T-A-S-I, which was the secret police. Now, after the fall of the Communist Empire, controlled largely by the former Soviet Union, when the new governments that came in, the German government, for example, took over that part of Germany that had been ruled by the communists, East Germany, they went into the archives and the files and the storage areas of Stasi, and they found documents and files on virtually every citizen. The League of Citizens that of East Germany under Stasi that were recruited and volunteered or were recruited without volunteering to spy on their fellow citizens ran into the millions. They found something else that was fairly interesting. They found vials, closed vials of air And what they discovered in reading the documentation that accompanied these vials of air was that these were vials of smells. And they had been gathered over the years where the police, the Stasi, had gone into somebody's apartment or office or had investigated pieces of clothing or whatnot. And they had put the smells, the odors, in these vials, maybe hoping for someday that, well, this might become valuable. It was an absolute nonsensical, of course. But is it that different from what our government is doing now in using the technology, not of the Cold War era, but of 2007, to listen into, to amass, to retain, and to manipulate, because at some point in the future, something that one of us might have said might be of interest to the government, or when analyzed in the context of something else that somebody else has said or done in the interim period, might suddenly reveal to some government brainiac who the next terrorist might be and from whence the next terrorist attack might come. They have to, at least our government nowadays under this administration, believes that it has to accumulate, gather, and retain all of that data, all of that information. So the National Security Agency, for example, maintains millions upon millions upon millions of pieces of data gleaned from email, internet trafficking, phone conversations, and the like. Because someday, somebody might use little bits of information in those communications to discover something that might, to a future, quote, commander-in-chief, close quote, be of interest on that battlefield out there, which, as Bruce indicated, entails every inch of the globe. Our streets, our communities, the streets and the communities in Europe, Afghanistan, Iraq, anywhere else. It's that mindset that the government exists apart, quite apart and separate from the people, to use the power that it sees fit for purposes that it desires now and in the future. And if anybody dares to raise a question about this, such as former Deputy Attorney General James Comey did in that darkened hotel room in which the White House counsel and the White House chief of staff, elected officials at the time, neither of them were elected officials, go to visit the Attorney General to try and get him highly sedated because of a very painful medical problem that he was under at the time, to sign off on the continuation of a surreptitious surveillance program for of American citizens and a data mining operation that, as far as we can tell, is still ongoing. These are issues, these are questions that we need to ask about, not just because of what they mean to those of us today living through this dark period in our nation's history, but of what they mean to future generations as well, and to the very fabric of our society based on that Constitution. The American Freedom Agenda's agenda is very simple. To go to our leaders, those candidates for president, for example, alone of which Ron Paul has signed off on the American Freedom Agenda, and ask them to stand up once again, as our founding fathers did, for the writ of habeas corpus. It actually means something, unlike the way our current Attorney General views it, as a throwaway, as something unimportant. To demand of our public officials and our candidates that they actually adhere to the rule of law. Revolutionary concept, but one that is important to all of us, certainly here tonight, and which is at the core of what the American Freedom Agenda, which brings together folks from across the ideological spectrum to once again stand for the Constitution of the United States, which uniquely and alone among all governing documents in the world reiterates and recognizes the proposition that we, the people, not you, the government, are the proper repositories for power in our human society. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, former Congressman Bob Barr, for your remarks. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speakers tonight are Bruce Fein and former Congressman Bob Barr. They are here to discuss the American Freedom Agenda. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, and my job of moderating is going to be easy tonight because, boy, did I get a lot of questions from the audience. And I would say this stack is related to one particular aspect and this to everything else, and that one aspect that is dominating is the I word, impeachment. Bruce Fein, you certainly have made a stir recently. As you can tell, it's probably more popular here in San Francisco than elsewhere.
1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is not popular.
Bruce, you have certainly drawn some attention for some of the issues that you've raised tonight in saying that you do think there is a basis for impeachment of not only President Bush but Vice President Cheney. Of some of the issues that have been outlined here tonight, we've talked about signing statements, domestic surveillance, torture, data mining, the indefinite detentions. Which of those, Bruce Fein, do you think could be potentially impeachable?
Well, if you look historically at articles of impeachment that have been voted against presidents, they have not been confined to just one isolated act. It's a political judgment, and typically it's based upon an evaluation that the president is an untrustworthy repository of power because of an attitude and a series of events that shows he has no inclination to obey the law. And that is true if you look at the three articles of impeachment voted against Richard M. Nixon, and I was there at the time, the articles against President Clinton, and the articles that would be drafted, I think, against George W. Bush. Now, what would the articles say? I think they would say something like this. President George W. Bush, in violation of his oath, faithfully to execute the office of the presidency and to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, has, in flagrant contradiction of that oath, violated a federal criminal statute, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, by wiretapping and intercepting emails of American citizens without warrants, without consulting Congress, and claiming at the same time that he could at any time break and enter our homes, open our mail, kidnap us, torture us if he thought it was important to gather foreign intelligence. He has suspended the writ of habeas corpus, combined judge, jury, and prosecutor in running military commissions, claimed the right to withhold from Congress and the American people secret spying programs forever, beyond any political or legal accountability, forever, and also claim the right to sign laws and disobey those portions he disagreed with. That's the gist of an article of impeachment against George W. Bush. And I want to go back and just underscore, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act has a criminal provision that says you are committing a felony if you act under color of state law or federal law outside of the statute without a warrant and conduct surveillance against American citizens. And that seems to me a conceded crime by the president and his subordinates based upon testimony given even by our inglorious Alberto Gonzalez.
Bob Barr, you were, during the impeachment of President Clinton, you were certainly at the forefront. What do you think of what you've described here tonight in terms of President Bush's violations of the rule of law? How does that compare with what you thought was sufficient to remove Bill Clinton from office?
On the one hand, as Bruce has indicated, and he certainly is a very, very distinguished constitutional scholar and historian, and he knows the writings reflected in the Federalist Papers, particularly some of those penned by Alexander Hamilton, to which we and others during the Nixon era turned to better understand the process of impeachment, what it means, when it was designed to be used, and so forth. And as Bruce has indicated, on the one level, we're talking about the same thing with all three of the individuals that Bruce mentioned, President Nixon, President Clinton, and President Bush, who illustrate a pattern of behavior that if you, again, go back to the constitutional debates, the Federalist Papers, clearly fall into that category of actions that Alexander Hamilton, for example, indicated, take activity away from that which is commonly understood to be within the prerogative of a president. Impeachment was not designed, for example, to be used as a tool to remove a president from office simply because we have decided we disagree with his policies or he's done something we don't like. Behavior that indicates either a violation of a law, and it does not have to be a violation of the law, but certainly that is a ground for an impeachment, but public behavior by a president in his public acts that rise to the level of undermining the laws and the principles of our Constitution. So on that level, we're looking at this sort of the same thing here. We're looking at an attitude, a disdain for the mechanisms of government and the foundation of our country. What puts this in a different and much more troubling category, as Bruce has indicated, is that we have what seems to be a systematic figurative thumbing of the nose at the specific laws of this land, not just the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, whose terms have been violated very specifically, very explicitly, and apparently with some regularity and consistency. We have the president using, as Bruce indicated also, this tool of a so-called signing statement, not to explain the application of a law to a particular aspect of an administrative process in the executive branch, but to lay the groundwork for ignoring and violating specific laws. It's hard to imagine, John, circumstances that would be more deeply troubling or that would not cry out for the type of exercise that would follow an impeachment inquiry.
Could I just add one personal footnote? My baptism in Washington was Watergate and the Nixon impeachment. And I remember in April of 1973, transfixed, when I saw a former White House counsel, just like Harriet Myers, former White House counsel, testify for the Senate Watergate Committee to his conversations with Richard M. Nixon in the Oval Office, chapter and verse. And it was John Dean's testimony that broke the Watergate cover-up scandal and led to the removal of Richard Nixon. That's how we got to know about the tapes and everything else. Even Richard Nixon, this is a president who said, if I do it, it's legal, did not have the audacity to suggest he could order John Dean to shut up or to kidnap him and tell him you can't be there. Yet this president, George W. Bush, has said precisely that. He can tell his former colleagues, you can't talk to the Congress of the United States about high crimes and misdemeanors. That is how far we've come. And yet in 1973, Congress finally had the gumption to stand up and tell the president, you're going to be impeached unless you leave office. What has this Congress done?
Nothing.
Reticence. This is after having won the Democrats a decisive victory in November. What are elections about if it's not about a change in policy? But that's just exemplary of the difference between George W. Bush and Richard Nixon and how we've come so far to disregard the Constitution.
If I could be the devil's advocate for a minute, or Tony Snow, if you will, the White House Press Secretary, I think the thing that we hear time and again from this administration is that this really is an extraordinary period after 9/11. And a lot of the tools, law enforcement tools that were used in the past, don't apply against this new enemy. Let's start with you this time, Bob Barr. What do you make of that rationalization?
It's just that. It's a rationalization. It has no basis in either current situation or in history. If one wants to find a time in our nation's history when we really faced an extraordinary challenge, go back to the very years surrounding the adoption of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Our nation's very existence was directly and significantly threatened by the greatest military power on the face of the earth, Great Britain. And yet, even in the face of that extraordinary threat to our nation's existence, our founding fathers recognized that in order to preserve that hard-won freedom that we had just fought so hard for and had given up so much, it was essential, absolutely essential, that they craft into the Bill of Rights, into the Constitution itself, very strict limitations on government power. Freedom requires those limitations, particularly in times when our nation is threatened. Are we threatened nowadays? Yes. Have we been threatened every year since then? Absolutely. There are always threats, internal and foreign, to our nation. But if we use any one of those threats to justify ignoring laws, ignoring the great writ of habeas corpus, convicting people based on secret evidence, maintaining the proposition that as the commander-in-chief, one person can decide that any other human being can be detained for the rest of their natural life simply because the president decides on a particular day they are a, quote, enemy combatant. If we don't have and if we don't demand limitations on government power in those times, then we have no right to claim the legacy of being American citizens. It is an absolute sophistry to claim that because we face a particular threat, and I think it's overblown, but even let's presume that we face this extraordinary, unprecedented danger, that still should never be any reason or justification or rationale for ignoring the laws of this land or the Constitution on which they are based.
Bruce Fine, what do you make of this argument?
Let me give four examples of the intellectual dishonesty of this administration that makes me think I'm rereading 1984. The first, the signature hypothetical of George W. Bush for flouting FISA is as follows. If Al-Qaeda is calling into the United States and American picks up, you want us to stop listening? No, of course not. Of course, the problem with the hypothetical is that when we are targeting Al-Qaeda, FISA never applies. It applies when you're targeting an American citizen on American soil. So it's a phony, specious hypothetical. There never has been a law that's constrained the ability of the United States to listen into a conversation that is targeted on someone abroad, even though he happens to speak to an American citizen. Second specious argument. He says, well, the current statute does require a warrant when a call between two foreigners happens to transit the United States. That is, I think, what you might call a deficiency or something that was overlooked at the time the statute was passed when the technology for routing calls was different. Well, myself and others, I assume Bob as well, have said, fine, just ask Congress to change the statute to say that just because a law transits the United States doesn't mean you need a warrant as long as you're targeting foreigners. They said, well, what's the problem with asking Congress to pass the statute? Well, we would disclose national security secrets if we informed Al-Qaeda that we're amending our law. You know, like we have to have secret laws, like the time of Caligula. Remember, he put them so high up on the wall no one could see them and he could trap them into violations. A third specious argument. It said that we need to have these military commissions that combine judge, jury, and prosecutors because, my gosh, without that kind of threat of summary justice, all sorts of international terrorists would escape. Of course, the problem with that is there's been one trial in 6 years with military commissions. One trial, not one of these super Al-Qaeda types. His name was David Hicks, an Australian. Sort of sounds like a young Che Guevara who didn't know what to do with his youth and trained in a terrorist training camp in Afghanistan. And he was tried before a military commission and got a sentence of 9 months. Now, why do you need a military commission for this? Because to have trained in a camp like he did would subject him to providing material assistance to a foreign terrorist organization. The identical crime charged against John Walker Lynn, remember, American Taliban from here. And where was John Walker Lynn tried? Not in a military commission. A federal court right near Washington, D.C. You know how many years he got? Remember, 20 years in prison. So why are these military commissions said so essential to be utilized when they give an anemic sentence once in 6 years and where the civilian courts are handing out 20-year sentences? Mr. Moussaoui was tried in the civilian court. Jose Padilla, another one who was initially identified as an enemy combatant, is now being tried in civilian court. And you know, this day, as we sit here, Osama bin Laden himself is under indictment. And where? In a federal civilian district court where he would be tried if we captured him. And then give me the last observation about this phoniness of how critical it is that we flout the rule of law because the danger is excessive. These are the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. And I wrote an article just, I think it's appeared today. Sometimes forget where my writings appear. But this is about several scores of those detainees. They're Uyghurs. It's hard to pronounce. Uyghurs? Has anyone even heard of a rumor that a Uyghur has killed an American? They're a group in northeast China that is a threat to the Chinese Communist Party. We're holding them at Guantanamo Bay as allegedly a great danger to the United States. They're there. They've been there 5-6 years. And no military official there thinks that the enemy combatant status is needed. We're trying to deport them. A commandant and former commandant at Guantanamo Bay themselves have said in interviews most of the people don't belong there. They were apprehended not by the United States but by the Northern Alliance, tribes and ethnic groups that have vendettas that they think that they can further by concocting claims of association with al-Qaeda. There's not a single crumb of evidence that suggests that we couldn't give every detainee there full access to habeas corpus and maintain our safety. Thanks.
I think one of the things, let me direct this question to Bob Barr, sort of the political equation on this. I mean, certainly the two of you have described some pretty harrowing violations of the Constitution here, yet the public does not seem to be widely outraged about that. Certainly in this area there is a lot. And I think one of the reasons may be that, you know, a lot of folks out there may have seen some Dirty Harry movies and think, you know, when you're going after the bad guys, sometimes you have to play a little rough. If you're not a terrorist, you don't have a lot to fear. But certainly there are aspects of this, such as the watch list for flying. I mean, I myself found out from two separate airlines that somehow I was on the TSA watch list, and that's before I was hanging out with you two. And vice versa. And certainly, which vice versa. Have you been on the watch list, Bob?
No, but I will be now that I'm sitting here with you.
Just don't email me. But certainly, you know, and Bruce as well has described some pretty draconian things that can be done to you in terms of suspension of freezing of assets and that kind of thing. At what point should the average law-abiding citizen be worried that these powers that the government is claiming for itself may be used against them?
Right now, this instant, tomorrow morning, when you wake up in the morning, American citizens, all of us, and everybody who is in the, it's not just American citizens, everybody who is in this country has a stake in these arguments, these principles, these problems that Bruce and you, John, have outlined. These are not theoretical issues. These aren't hypothetical issues. As everybody who picks up a phone or uses a cell phone, everybody who uses the internet to communicate with a loved one, with a colleague, with a son, a daughter, a student, whoever, now runs the risk, sort of this new panopticon society, even though none of us may know that a particular phone call or a particular email or a particular piece of mail is being opened. We all know now that this government may be doing that, probably is doing that, and even if they aren't today, they probably will tomorrow. When you go in to purchase an automobile or a home, the USA Patriot Act requires that you submit certain information to that agent of the government. Virtually everybody who works for a financial institution is now a surrogate agent of the government collecting information. You have to be approved. You have to get the government's permission to get on a plane. You have to get the government's permission in order to buy a car. You have to get the government's permission to make sure that you aren't on one of those watch lists in order to purchase a house. Everybody needs to be concerned about this right now. These are not hypotheticals any longer. This is very, very real, and it affects every one of us in every aspect of our lives.
Just as a side, before I go to Bruce Fine, for those of us, and I found out when I wrote a column about this, that there are an awful lot of Americans who are also on the watch list. And the thing you don't know is whether, I assume it was a case of mistaken identity or somebody with the same name or some other characteristic, the government will not tell you whether you're on the watch list. You can just apply to be taken off the watch list, and the only information, and you never know how it's ultimately resolved, they will only confirm the information that you gave them. Does this sound like the country you live in, Bruce Fine?
No, it sounds like a country that I read about in reading Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. Now, let me give a couple of examples why I think everyone ought to be worried. The church committee that held the hearings on the family jewels, so-called, of the CIA, that led to the enactment of FISA, showed that there were illegalities that had been ongoing for 30 years that weren't revealed. The illegal mail openings, illegal seizures of international telegrams, misuse of the CIA gathering files, 10,000 of them, according to former director of the CIA, William Colby, on dissidents because Nixon and Johnson wanted to pin some foreign influence on them. They couldn't imagine why you could oppose their policies unless you were being bribed by the Soviet Union, because they were infallible. So that simply because we don't have the corpses on the street doesn't mean that these files aren't being illegally compiled and sitting there like a sword of Damocles being leaked out could damage our professional or credit or other hopes. There's a second reason as well, and even though it's probably true that the president has not utilized to the maximum the authority he has claimed, it does set a precedent, in the words of Robert Jackson, Supreme Court Justice, who's also a prosecutor at Nuremberg, that lie around like loaded weapons that will be utilized by any successor. You bet there's another 9/11, he won't be so restrained. Right now, the victims are largely people whose names are difficult to pronounce, but it'll soon be Jones and Brown and Johnson if there's another 9/11. Power is never yielded back by any executive branch. And lastly, think about 410 AD. You know, Rome was sacked by Alaric the Great, but it was a sacking that occurred after centuries of deterioration of the Roman civic culture and of their attachment to any kind of principles of republicanism. And the fact is, we have an obligation for those yet to be born, just like those founding fathers and those who died at Cemetery Ridge or the Battle of the Bulge were fighting for our freedom as well, even though we weren't there to vote or to give campaign contributions, because democracy can be lost on the installment plan. Even if we aren't the ones who feel the collapse of the Constitution, shouldn't we be concerned about posterity as well? Because they do not want to inherit a crumbling Constitution, just as we did not. And that's another reason why we need to be alert, just to show that we are concerned for posterity as our ancestors were for us.
Let's go back to Bob Barr. Bob, you visited our editorial board several months ago, and we talked about, at that time, you thought that there was at least enough there for hearings into possible impeachable offenses. How do you feel now? We're at this point, six, 7 months away from the primary season. The election's just a little over a year from now. There doesn't seem a great deal of appetite among Democrats, including Speaker Nancy Pelosi, to consider impeachment. They're feeling that this would take up all the oxygen in Washington and other important issues would be pushed aside. What do you think? Is it worth at this point initiating some kind of hearings?
It's always an appropriate time to initiate hearings in support of the Constitution, the rule of law, and the very fabric of our society. The question that I think your question begs is, where are the leaders? They obviously are not in Washington. There are very few in Washington. There are very few in either party. As Bruce mentioned, the elections of November of 2006 brought the Democrat Party, after being outside the majority in the Congress for 12 years, back into the majority. There have been, to be sure, in the Senate, for example, under the chairmanship of Senator Leahy, some very important, very substantive hearings inquiring into many of these issues. But the Democrats seem to fall prey to the same, maybe not to the same extent, but to the same problem that the Republicans did when they were in power. They simply don't seem to have the interest or the wherewithal to keep going They look for a quick headline. They look for a quick hearing, for a sort of gotcha soundbite. The best example was last week when the Attorney General made an appearance before the Senate Judiciary Committee. There certainly seems to be a discrepancy between his testimony and the testimony of at least two other individuals who were similarly placed under oath when they appeared before the Senate, James Comey, the former deputy and acting attorney general, and FBI Director Robert Mueller. Yet during the questioning of Mr. Gonzalez and immediately after there was a great hoopla over whether or not what he said about the substance of the disagreements in the administration that gave rise to the darkened hospital room visit with the Attorney General at the time, Mr. Ashcroft. Actually, he wasn't the Attorney General. He had ceded power to Mr. Comey, who was the acting Attorney General. And then everybody just sort of runs to the microphones and runs to the telephones and talks about this great discrepancy. They're losing sight of the forest for the trees. The questions ought to be going as to go into the issue of, now, wait a minute, if you, Mr. Attorney General, say that you were discussing a program different from the program that Mr. Mueller says you were talking about, what actually is going on here? Are there things that we don't even know? I mean, how many programs were there? How much data mining is there? How many people were you listening into? Congress doesn't seem to have the leaders and the understanding of how to really probe and probe and probe and probe and ask the tough questions as opposed to flitting off after these little points of light, to use a metaphor from another administration, and getting a quick headline. This is more important than a quick headline, than a quick soundbite. They ought to have Mr. Gonzalez up there every day until he answers the questions, which he has not addressed thus far.
Bruce Fein?
Impeachment is a political judgment, and you can understand prudential concerns at time of war, and post 9/11 certainly is heightened danger of not distracting a president if it is a distraction from his duties. But that doesn't seem to me to be the case at present, but could be wrong. One of the things that Nancy Pelosi did before there was even one committee assignment was to say impeachment is off the table. Now, that is like writing out of the Constitution the Bill of Rights. It's Article 2, Section 4. It's still there. No one has the unilateral authority to deny the ability of the Congress of the United States and the people indirectly to remove someone from office if they are abusing their power and create a clear and present danger to our liberties and certainly to the liberties of our posterity because the precedent's being set. Now, what is going in Congress? I think there are two things that are driving it to inactivity. Not masterly inactivity, I think quite cowardly inactivity. One is a thorough ignorance of the Constitution. Bob and I are up there every day. They could not recite one-tenth of what's in the Constitution of the United States and what are the duties of a legislator. Not options, the duties. For example, every member of Congress takes an oath to defend and support the Constitution of the United States, which means asking people like Alberto Gonzalez, this is a democracy and it's transparency. You answer the question whether there are any spying programs that haven't leaked yet to the New York Times that you wanted to keep secret forever. And if you don't answer the question, you're going to be held in contempt or you have no money to operate your department. You answer, Mr. Gonzalez, this is the United States. It's not the Soviet Union. It's not Chinese communists. That's what you're about. Secrecy is not the rule in a democracy. Sunshine is the best disinfectant because it deters lawlessness and maladministration. And you get up and you leave this room because you have no money unless you answer those questions. Because this is now a year and a half after the New York Times disclosure that we still do not know these secret programs. Now, what might they consist of? Well, we can go back, if we have a memory, to the Houston Plan developed under Richard M. Nixon. Charles Houston was a junior aide in the White House, and Richard Nixon in 1970 thought there was revolutionary violence afoot. He thought the Bastille was about to be stormed because people were disagreeing with his Vietnam policy. So he summoned all his intelligence chiefs and asked them to survey what restraints on electronic surveillance and other spying there was and to come up with a plan that would enable him more closely to supervise his detractors. And they came up with the Houston plan that called for illegal mail openings. And indeed, the recommendations describe this as illegal mail openings, illegal electronic surveillance, illegal burglaries, the infiltration on every college campus of spies. And all of this is done in secret, and Richard Nixon approves it. Now, what caused 5 days later the disapproval? The great civil libertarian J. Edgar Hoover approached Nixon and said, no, I'm not signing off. He wanted a domination of all the spying programs. He didn't want the CIA encroaching on his territory. That is the kind of thing that happens with secrecy. Spies are paid and promoted to spy, not to protect civil liberties. And as Bob insinuated, they believe every scrap of evidence should be preserved forever. Because maybe in the year 2050, this will be a small piece in a jigsaw puzzle that will, like an epiphany, give them the clue to where Osama bin Laden is hiding. Now, they still have letters of Jane Fonda lying around, according to Bill Colby, you know, that she sent during the Vietnam War, because she was the next incarnation of a terrorist. That is what is so dangerous about this claim that they can run all of these programs in secret from us. And because they're doing everything to try to minimize the likelihood of 9/11. And that's an important point to focus on. Everything? Well, if they're doing everything, then may lock us all up. What further way to assure that we're not engaged in terrorism and put us all in prisons? That's the logic of what their rationale is. They have no limitations on what they say they will do in the name of trying to defeat international terrorism. And I, as I pointed out earlier, it makes us less safe. Because when we do that, foreign countries, our foreign allies will say, we aren't cooperating anymore. We do not want to live in a world that's Hobbesian and where the great Western civilization that sought to bring enlightenment, the rule of law, now turns back to the Pleistocene age.
Well, we've talked a bit about Congress and whether through political timidity or political calculations seems to have no stomach for impeachment at this point. But I don't also hear an awful lot from the presidential candidates about these issues, the issues that you gentlemen are raising tonight about civil liberties and overreaching of executive power. Here's an audience question. Can we trust that a Democratic administration would relinquish this power once the Bush administration leaves office? We'll start with you, Bob.
Absolutely not. No administration, Republican or Democrat, under the current political system or structure that we have, which essentially excludes all but the two major parties and those anointed by the powers that be in those two parties, even very, very strong candidates, and I use the word strong in terms of their understanding of and adherence to the Constitution and their advocacy of the Constitution. Even those candidates have virtually nil chance to be elected because the national media hasn't anointed them. The two major political parties don't. They are not able to raise the money that the two major political parties, through manipulation of the federal campaign laws, are able to do to the exclusion of virtually any third or independent party other than a particular individual of great wealth like a Ross Perot or a Michael Bloomberg. So the current system is very much stacked against anybody who really asks these tough, independent questions. And again, as Bruce mentioned and as I've indicated, and I think common sense tells all of us here, no administration, Republican or Democrat, is going to return power that its predecessor of a different party enjoyed. That's largely why neither party, if it is out of power, really wants to do an awful lot to harm or weaken the party that's in power, because they know that sooner or later that pendulum will shift back to them, and they don't want to inherit a presidency that has been weakened because they weakened that prior president of their own party. So this is largely a problem of the fact that we have allowed our political system to become weighted down as the status quo, and why I think it's so very important that we try and support some of these other candidates, why we also should look to a third party and not be satisfied with simply having the two major parties, because they are the two major parties, choose a candidate from among those that has been that have been anointed by the powers that be of that status quo system.
We're running out of time, but Bruce Fine, I want to give you a chance to quickly weigh in. Do you anticipate that these powers, if unchecked at this point, will continue in perpetuity?
Yes, we've never witnessed in the history of mankind any branch of government voluntarily yielding power. The Founding Fathers knew what human nature was like, and those who gravitate to the political spectrum have a special gratification in dominating others. That's why they feared unchecked power and chose checks and balances.
I want to thank American Freedom Agenda Chairman Bruce Fine and former Congressman Bob Barr for being here tonight. And I have to say, I've done a lot of these Commonwealth Club events, and this is certainly the most questions I have. So we'll end on a hopeful note that it looks like you certainly have stirred a lot of thought and discussion. And thanks so much. This has been terrific.
Thank you.
And I want to thank as well our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.